Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Guy.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Kevin Rowland, Dexys yes. Midnight Runners. Wow. He was such a presence in the 80s. I remember being everyone being maybe a little nervous. You didn't want to kind of get Kevin on the wrong foot, you know, back in those days, did
incredibly,
you?
Yeah, incredibly intense. And I mean, because he carried over, it was that whole punk ethos of just absolutely meaning it and being genuine, wasn't it? Which he took to kind of extremes, and the band lived almost like a cult, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I think he got them to exercise and do running together and stuff. But also, I remember when they didn't speak to the press and they put ads in the press with statements about what they were doing. There was one statement that went in where Kevin said that he thought that there was nearly a coup about to be attempted in the band where they were going to get rid of him. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff. I mean,
they did a tour, and they actually advertised it, mentioned that their tour was they were bunking the train. So they're like, it's like everyone knew in advance that they were basically just traveling on trains without tickets. Which seems, if I was a tour or if I was booking a tour, I'd be like, mate, I'm not sure this is the way we want to go about this. Also, but, you know, it's worth remembering the trains were in public ownership at the time, so that's not actually a very socialist thing to do.
Oh. Well, I'm not going to be the one to tell him.
I'm not. That's what I'm saying now.
But you know what he did do? He knocked Billie Jean off of number one in America.
Wow.
Yeah, now come on, Eileen.
That is seismic. Yeah, that record was just one of the most omnipresent things, wasn't it? It was so everywhere.
It was with the Siobhan.
When I used to work with Alan and Win Stanley, who produced it, who had this used to have this fabulous big studio under the flyover in Notting Hill, and they said it was Come On Eileen bought it.
Yeah, extraordinary record with Siobhan Fahey's from Bananarama's sister in the video. Do you remember?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And also, you know, Kevin's clothes. You know, he's very important to him. His look, the look of the band.
Yeah,
and the way
it's like every album is a look.
It's enough of us, right? Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Kevin.
Ah. How are you?
Hey, Kevin.
Look at that. Are you in Miami?
Thailand, not too far off.
You're in Thailand?
I am.
Oh, my word.
Certainly dressed for it. Well, of course, but you're always dressed for it, aren't you, wherever you are.
Well, thank you. Thank you for busting into your holiday for us.
Man, come on.
Where in Thailand are you, if you don't mind us saying? If you don't mind us
yeah,
asking.
I'm just near Jomtien, a few miles from Pattaya.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, lovely.
You're looking very fine in that shirt. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Is the light all right, or am I a bit dull?
No, you're good.
Dull is not a word one would ever associate with you.
Oh, thank you very much for that. I'll take
Kevin, thanks for coming on. You know, I've been trying to get you on for a while. You know that.
Finally,
you're here, and you're. We should talk about because I saw you were on the front cover of
Classic Pop.
Classic Pop.
I am.
And I loved, you know what I liked about it? The first thing I noticed is the lineup of the four of you, you know, with Helen and with Jim, obviously.
Yeah.
Is you're still thinking about Roxy Music. It's got the vibe to this picture.
Yeah,
Of that inner sleeve of, you know.
Yeah, the inner sleeve of the second album, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm quite upfront about my influences. You know, why not? Those were just iconic shots, you know.
Did that influence you getting Neil Hubbard to play in the band?
No, I saw Kokomo in about 75, 76, and absolutely loved them.
They were amazing, that band, yeah.
They were one of the best British soul bands, really, you know.
Yeah.
Right up there with the Average White Band for me. They were just great at that time. And
well, actually, one of the greatest, most underappreciated bass players Alan Spinner.
Alan Spinner, just
one of my absolute heroes.
Really? Me too.
Yeah.
What a player. Neil Hubbard said that Alan Spinner would just like create like a carpet effect under, you know, just make you feel really good that you could just play on the top of it, whatever you're playing, you know.
Because we'll go back to your roots later. Because I mean, obviously, soul is something that was big in your life in the 70s, as it was for me as well. I know, Guy. Sure.
Yeah.
But just to kick off talking about the fact you got this remix of 2RIA.
Yep.
As it could have sounded, right?
Yeah, it should have sounded. As it should have sounded. It was going to be could have. Now it should have.
Does that mean, were you thinking that at the time? Were you thinking,
definitely. And I went to the label and I said, this isn't right. Some of the tracks are great. Eileen come out really good. The Waltz, one or two others. But, you know, quite a lot of them, that sound isn't right, you know. And I said to the label, look, we need to do some more mixing. And they went, no, budget spent. That's it. And our stock was quite low at that time. You know, we hadn't had any hits for a while. Funnily enough, Gary, you had reviewed our previous single, Celtic Soul Brothers, on Round Table.
Oh, shit.
Oh man, you gave it a good review. You did.
Oh, thank you.
I can just imagine. I'm sorry. I can just imagine how Gary's heart stopped at that moment when you said that.
We all think the worst, don't we? When we think things like that. But no, I was just going to say, I used to go on there and slag records off and try and sound clever. If I was doing that again now, you know, I'd think about, you know what? This is probably some new group. Their mum's listening. All the family are listening in, you know.
Yeah.
You don't realize, you don't think about that at the time. But anyway, there you go.
That's right. No, because
not to mention all the work. That's what always gets me. True. All the work that's gone in, and like months and planet, and then you just go, no, shit.
Exactly.
I'm trying to get Alan Partridge or Alan Partridge. What am I talking about? Not Alan Partridge, but from XTC.
Oh, Andy Partridge, yeah.
Andy Partridge.
Andy Partridge, Jesus Christ. This is Alan Partridge. We've got a mutual friend. And I said, ask Andy if he'd want to come on to Rock on Tours. And he asked him and he said, no, Andy said he doesn't think you'll have him on because he said something mean about Spandau Ballet once. I mean, we were all kids doing the same, really? Having the same war, weren't we, the charts.
And that's how it was, wasn't it? You had your tribe and, you know, they were in that tribe and that was how it was.
Yeah. So have you gone back in with the original tapes? Who's mixing it, remixing it?
Pete Schwer. He remixed, he mixed Don't Stand Me Down and he's mixed every Dixies album since then and recorded, you know, so he's our guy. He's totally our guy, you know. He's really musical. He understands dynamics and drama in music and subtleties and, you know, and we finished it. You know, he's just been like sending us, myself and Helen, he's been sending us mixes, you know, and then we comment, we talk between ourselves, then we sent the comments back to Pete, and then he would, you know, make any adjustments until we were all happy, you know, and then that was it.
One thing I've noticed on all your albums, since from Don't Stand Me Down, we'll get to all this later, is that you like really roomy sounding drums. It's really nice, like you're in the room with the drums.
I suppose so. Yeah, I wanted to sound like drums because I can remember, like, before I really understood about that, I'd go into the studio where we'd all be playing and think, oh, man, this sounds great. Drums are sounding great. Guitar sounding great. And then you go into the control room and I think, oh, it's not sounding as good. And I'd realise because the mics are really close up to the instrument.
Yeah.
Too close and there's no room in it. There's no space. So, you know, you're not hearing what you hear in the room. You're just hearing, you know, what's like an inch away from the drums or the amplifier or whatever, you know. Yeah,
I think, you know, what's I'm re-listening to a lot of your stuff in the last few days is
which has been great.
Is you want to try and capture this spirit of a gang on stage, you know. Even in your records there's a sense of street and place about what you do, you know, whether it's even on Tour A when it feels like a sort of an Irish West Side Story. But at the same time, you know, you might zoom in and focus on a couple. Zoom in and couple on focus on a couple.
Box side story.
focus on a couple of people talking quietly in a pub. You know, that might be part of the song. So I think your albums always have this theatricality.
Drama, yeah. Yeah, true. I mean, you know, it's like somebody said to me recently, I did an interview about a year, 2 years ago, and they said, why do you quite often have talking on your records? And I didn't really answer it. I just thought, well, why wouldn't you? It's just another colour, isn't it? And, you know, we're talking about soul music. And, if you listen to a lot of soul records, there's often talking on them. You know, if you listen to The Shy Lights, Have You Seen Her? It's like a minute talking. Barry White records. You know, loads of records have soul records have talking, but very few rock records will have talking on them, funnily enough.
That's right. Well, who was the band who went through their star signs? Who was that? It was
The Floaters.
The Floaters. Float
Larry.
On.
Yeah. Larry, Pisces.
Yeah, that was just like the classified set to music, wasn't it? It was a sort of pre-Tinder.
But I also heard that you've got like people like Robbie Williams redoing some vocals on tracks. That can't be for the original album. Is this as a sort of bonus tracks?
We were doing some extra tracks. We were going to do that, but it looks like we're not now. We were going to do that. You know how these things go with the label. We thought it was a great idea, and they went, how much? I mean, it wasn't going to cost a fortune, but, you know, anyway. So it looks like that won't be happening now. Although Robbie's done his, actually, and he's done a really good version of Jackie Wilson Said.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. David Holmes was going to do Liars A to E. And Adrian Dunbar, he's best known as an actor, but he's a really good musician, he's a really good singer and bass player.
Bass player? I did not know that. Well, he's best known for Jesus, Mary, Joseph and the Wee Donkey.
Yeah. Anyway, he was going to do a version of All in All, the Waltz off the album. But anyway.
Oh, wow.
It's probably not completely gone, but it looks like it might be, I'm being told.
His voice would be great on it because obviously, you know, it was a huge Irish influence on the record.
Yeah. Yeah. And I met up with him. We talked through the song and he really got it, you know, So I was quite up for that.
Because your time growing up in Ireland, Kevin, it wasn't as long as all that, I don't think, from what I've read, but it's made massive impression on your life.
Just 3 years, wasn't it? No.
Blimey. You know me better than I know me. It was 3 years from the age of 1 to 4. Yeah, my parents were sort of going back and forth. So my dad had started a building business and that went in Wolverhampton and that had gone down. So he had to sell his house and get rid of his business and that. And my mum and the four kids went over to Ireland to my dad's little farm, you know, in the west of Ireland. And my dad stayed in England working. So for 3 years. Yeah, that was not uncommon in those days with the Irish. And then we moved to Wolverhampton when I was 4. And then London when I was 11.
But even though you were in Wolverhampton and London, was there a sense of Irishness about your upbringing, as it were, about your culture?
It was. I often say that, you know, like second generation Irish is almost like a social class, really. It's like, you know, and I've talked to other second generation Irish, like recording artists about it, the likes of Johnny Marr. Feel similar about
Johnny it. Said a brilliant thing because do you know what? It's funny because there's a thing in the Come On Eileen video which is where all the guys lining up and getting in the van, which is what the Irish workers used to do in the morning. Because I remember Johnny Marr saying to me years ago, he said, "Guy, you remember when you were a kid?" He said, "You remember those guys you saw in 3-piece suits digging up the road?" I went, "Yeah, of course." He said, "Those were my uncles."
Yeah,
and that was the Irish thing. Everyone you saw, they all had a 3-piece suit on. It was brilliant.
They were all in the building. You know, my dad was in the building trade. Everybody at school. So it was mostly Irish kids at school, you know. But no one really talked about that. But it was kind of drummed into you at home. And it's been a bit of a love-hate thing, really. But, you know.
Right.
And the two things were really mixed in together, you know.
But was Irish music in your house a lot?
Some of the time, but you know what it was. I mean, my mum had it more, and she would sing songs and that. You know, like we would sing more like than have records in those days. And my dad was a little bit he was kind of ambivalent about the Irish thing. And I said to him, and he passed a year ago, he was nearly 103 when he passed.
Oh, wow. No, Kevin, that means you're going to be making albums for a long time if the genetics are right.
Well, Dad didn't do any exercises or anything, so I'm doing exercise and stuff, so I reckon I'm going to make about 140. But I said to him a few years ago, I said, why did you really not want to be part of the Irish community? Because we sort of were, but we weren't. And he said, there was an awful lot of drink in it. There was his exact words, you know, and there was a lot of drink in it. And I mean, he told me, like, he would be working with guys. They used to call them long distance men. They would walk, you know, 20 miles, 30 miles to a job. They'd work for a couple of weeks on a building, laboring, working all the hours God sent. Then they'd pack in. They'd be living rough, a lot of them. Then they'd go on the booze for a few weeks. They'd do the money, and then they'd start all over again, you know. And yeah. They were hard men, and they'd die young and all that. So I think he was. And he said he used to even, like, they'd take the piss out of him and say, like, where'd you go? Where'd you come from yesterday? And he went to Coventry, and not be 20 miles away. And they go, you didn't get a bus, did you? You walked it, right? And they go, yeah, I walked it. Or, where'd you sleep last night? You didn't sleep in a digs, did you? You slept rough. Yeah, I slept rough. You know, because that was the kind of culture. And if you weren't in it, they'd take the piss out of you, you know. And he didn't want that, you know.
But, you know, Kevin, you could be describing the kind of band you were trying to create with those early sexes. Yeah. You know,
because that's this sense
of unity, and, you know, that I think was so apparent with your group, you know, that dressing people the same, you know, the commitment to the band. You know, there's all those rumours about exercising together, which I get the spirit of that, you know. But it feels the same thing. It feels like if you're not committed 100%, don't bother.
It's true. And, you know, I mean, for better or worse, you know, my dad was very strict growing up, and I was very influenced by him, no doubt about it. You know what I mean?
Is that where the drive came from? Because your drive was certainly then.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Phenomenal. It was ridiculous, yeah. Really. I mean, it was too much, you know. It was like I never knew how to switch off, you know. So, but yeah,
because there is a part of with a band, it is about having your own culture and being about moving forward as a unit. But you are meant to be having fun.
This is true. This is true.
I know you're on record as saying maybe I should have had a bit more fun.
Well, that was the original idea, you know, getting a band and do all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then it got a bit serious. I must admit, you know, I mean, in all seriousness, I found it very difficult being in a band, you know, trying to lead a band. Pressure of writing songs. I don't know if you felt the same way, Gary, you know, all of that. And trying to, you know, I just felt I was over-responsible. And I don't think I was really equipped for it, looking back.
Because the way you were approaching it was fantastic. I love this thing of literally hanging around outside the Birmingham Conservatoire to sort of solicit classical musicians, right, so to stop you having to get old session players.
Wow. Oh, you really have done your research. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's what we did. It was like, okay, you grab him.
Brilliant.
It was a bit like a press gang.
Yes.
Kevin, what was...
I love the press gang, the conservatoires. Yeah. So they all had to drink out of pints of jugs with glass bottoms so they could see you coming.
Kevin, what was the music, though, that first turned you on?
I'd say Elvis, you know, like... Yeah. I mean, I was interested in music from the off. I wasn't one of these guys who just kind of got into it in my teens or 12, 13. Like, from the off, you know, singing and, yeah. And Elvis, I'd seen pictures of him before I'd heard him, you know. And then, because you know what it was like in those days, you know, you had a radio. We didn't have a TV at that point. Yeah. We had a radio. And I don't think Elvis was on it. But, and there wouldn't be that much pop music. This is pre-Radio One. So I was born in 53. So about 62, I think Elvis had Can't Help Falling in Love, which I think was either number one or number two. And I heard that, you know, I was just like, wow, you know.
Because it's funny how we have these kind of people that we still aspire to all our lives. It's in the background, you know, like we mentioned Roxy Music and Brian Ferry, obviously, earlier. And Elvis, and you know, and I think, you know, the Beatles obviously come into a lot of people's minds, but it's... They're there forever for you to compare yourself to. Because I know you're a man who, you know, interested in your voice, interested in the way you look. And I guess he's there in a way. Like, he's instead of putting a picture of Jesus or the Pope up on your wall, in your mind, you've got a picture of Elvis there forever.
Yeah. I mean, he was just incredible, wasn't he? I mean, it's just, he looked amazing. He sounded so much love in his voice, you know. Wow. And he was just unique.
And then, so then what was next? When was it, what was it that made you think maybe this is something you could do or should
do? I think from the very beginning, it was never in quite, it was what I wanted to do from the youngest, you know, right. Like from about 7, 8, 9, you know, I just thought I want to do that. But then what happened to me is I got into teens, I tried to learn the guitar when I was about 10 or 11, but I was having like learning difficulties at that time. I'd probably be described with, what do they call it now? ADHD. Looking back, I would say that would be the case. But so I just found it like maths, really, and I couldn't really learn. So and through my teens, I just thought, well, I'll never be able to do this, you know. And I did try a couple of times. When I was about 13 or 14. A couple of mates were forming bands. And I tried as a singer for this one thing. And I just, it was the first time I'd used the microphone. And as soon as I heard my voice, I just went, ah, forget it. I'm not doing it. And I just thought it won't happen, you know. And then I was very, very lucky because I moved to Birmingham in 74. And my brother, Pete, he was 6 years older than me, and he had a social club band. And he was playing the bass. It was a trio, covers they were doing. And he said to me, the guitarist, Steve Skidmore, was leaving. But because they were good mates, they'd given him 6 months' notice. So he said,
that's a great name for a guitarist. Sorry.
Steve Skidmore.
Steve Skidmore.
Yeah, and he's a great guitarist too, really, really good. So Pete said, Kev, if you learn all the songs in 6 months, you're in. So now that I had this, you know, goal, yeah, I could do it. And I was just about good enough after 6 months.
6 months, that's nice. I mean, that's, especially at that age, that's a nice long window. That was good.
It is. You know, my brother Pete was a teacher and he gave me a great bit of advice. He said, because I was trying to do it for 2 hours, 3 hours a night, driving myself crazy. He said, look, just do half an hour a night, but do it every night. Just do half an hour. And that's what I did. And so I was very lucky. Got into Pete's band. And then he said, you want to sing one? Because he did all the singing. I went, nah, go on then. And I tried one and it sounded horrible in the mic. And I didn't sing again. And about 3 months later, I'd do a few backing vocals and I'd eventually sing one, you know. Then I started writing the odd one or two and he very kindly let me put them in the set because nobody wanted to hear original songs. It was all Elvis, Beatles, all that stuff, you know.
Do those songs still exist?
The ones I wrote.
Yeah.
That one, there was one particular that he let me put in the set called Girly. I don't think it was that great. No, not really.
And this is before punk has happened.
Yeah, this would be 75.
I'd read somewhere you had a band that was very sort of Roxy influenced as well. That was your first kind of proper band, as it were. Yeah. I mean, is that true? Was it, were you doing glam rock at that point?
Not glam, but when I say Roxy, it was more like Roxy 74, 75, and more like Def Skool, you know, like greased back hair, you know, and makeup and, you know, peg trousers and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that was Clive Langer, wasn't it?
Clive Langer was in Def Skool. They were an incredible band.
They were brilliant.
They were another band that should have done really, really well, you know.
This is where our lives first met. In 1977, Kevin.
True.
You know, I don't know. It's funny how when you appeared as Dexys in later on, we all knew it was the same bloke because you obviously made such an impression on us. Spandau then was, we had a different bass player. My brother wasn't playing. It was a guy called Richard Miller. And we were called the Makers. And we were playing power pop, basically. Yeah. That kind of, you know, Gen X type music, you know, and the big place to play in those days was the Roxy.
It was
in London, in Covent Garden, which was the punk gig.
Yeah.
And there's a great website you can go to now, by the way, called boredteenagers.co.uk, okay. Which is fantastic, which is sort of history of sort of unknown punk groups. And there's the list of all the nights at the Roxy. And in July 1977, we play a band called Transistor, a band called The Stinky Toys, and The Killjoys, is your band.
The headlining, they were French punk,
I remember them. They were quite known, yeah.
They were, The Stinky Toys.
And you were in your band, The Killjoys. It was a punk band. And I remember Steve Dagger, who managed us and still managed Spandau on and on, being really impressed by you because you went off, you did your sound check, and then both of you went off and had a drink in the pub.
Yeah, we, I think we sat outside, but we chatted for about an hour or more. I remember it well. Yeah, I remember it. I remember it, all of it well. Yeah, and I also remember, I think it was your drummer's dad.
Yeah.
Brought the gear in a pickup.
Stan. Yeah.
Was it Stan? Yeah.
Yeah.
Brought all your gear in the back of the truck, and you sort of.
That's right. Because actually, I could imagine, because you and Steve Dagger are very similar people, very, you know, visionary people. On how, you know, I think Malcolm McLaren had been a quite a big influence on how you could create a band and drive it forward, and what needed to be done, and the commitment and the philosophy that is involved in all of that. So I'm not surprised you hit it off.
Oh, wow. And do you know, exactly the same happened with when I saw a picture of you guys, when you guys first started the records. And I said to my mate, Pete Barrett, who you might know, did a lot of artwork design for loads of bands, you know. Anyway, I says to Pete, I said, I remember them as a punk band called The Makers. And he went, no. He said, no, they weren't in a punk band. Is it the Cavalry or you called yourself? No, what was it? Didn't you have another name in between?
Oh, yeah, Gentry.
The Gentry. Not far off. Okay. He said, no. He said, they were in a band called The Gentry before. I said, I'm sure I recognise them.
We denied that history at that point. Of course.
Everything was so Stalinist, wasn't it? Where, like, in punk, you had to deny your prog roots before that, and then with the new romantic, you had to deny your punk roots. And then,
you'd have a good memory in those days, you know.
Kevin, I watched a little interview with you last night, actually, from early 2000s, and you said something that really moved me because I'm not sure it's true, but you said, this is the story of unfulfilled potential about your band. Is that how you still feel?
I try not to think about it too much. Oh, but man, you know, we've made some disastrous decisions and stuff. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and I could have written more, really. Could have written more songs. And
What's the writing process like for you? Do you write on your own? I mean, because you, in the early days, you always had a partner, didn't you?
Usually. I write a few of the songs, the Dexys songs on my own, but most of them would be with Kevin Archer or Jim.
Yeah.
It was slightly different with Kevin Archer. He would more or less, in the first album, he would like just write music and then just present it. And I would write words and sometimes a melody on top. With Jim, we'd do everything together from scratch, from the drum beat to the chord sequence to everything together. You know, that's the second album. And then the same with the third Dexys album of the 80s, Don't Stand Me Down. Me, Helen and Billy wrote that.
But when did the concept of Dexys come together? How did it form in your mind? And how did you, you know, the look, the sound? Because it's so unique. It wasn't like anyone else at the time.
No, I think it was about early 78. I was in the Killjoys and, you know, it wasn't going anywhere. And we were trying to change, you know, probably to be a bit more like power poppy, because that seemed to be the thing at the moment, and all of that, and trying to change, really. We started to do like a couple of 50s songs, like I think we did Dream Lover and Great Balls of Fire. It wasn't really going to go anywhere, and we'd already got a name as a punk band, and while, I think once you've shown yourself as one thing, it's very hard to, you know, to change, really. And so I think I realised that people would want to dance again, you know, and just had the idea for soul music, you know. And Kevin Archer joined the band, and very early on, after he joined the Killjoys, you know, I brought him around my place one night and I played him a song I'd written called Tell Me When My Light Turns Green, which I hadn't shown to the Killjoys. And he went, that's soul, that is. And I went, I know. And I just went, you know, long term, that's the plan. And he was like, okay, so... When that group broke up, which was a few months later, we just got straight on and formed Dexys. But to answer your other question, you know, unfulfilled potential, I think like with Come and Eileen, which was a big hit. And
oh, you think?
Yeah. Well,
Christ.
No, it was. But, you know, I mean, at the time, it's a long story, but the label didn't even want to release that. They wanted to release Jackie Wilson said. We had to fight for that. It just shows you how funny things go. But after it, so the deal was, I made a deal with the label. Look, okay, let's do Eileen first. And, you know, we'll do Jackie Wilson after. In the end, they said, okay. And then Eileen's number one for 4 weeks. And we've written one of the most original songs. It's come out of the year, you know. It's done really well. And I went and did an interview with David Jensen, who'd pioneered Come On Eileen. He was the first one to play it, and he was pushing it, and he really liked it. And he went All In All, which All In All is One Last Wild Waltz, off the album. He said, for the next single, gotta be. And I was like, fantastic. And I went back to the label. Look, David Jensen wants it. He's going to get behind it. You know, this has got to be the next single. They went, no, Jackie Wilson said. And I was like, and, you know, we argued. And my manager was on the Jackie Wilson thing as well. And in the end, what happened is, I said, look, we've just released a string-leaden thing, you know, and now we're going to, this is a brass thing. And they said, oh, well, let's dub strings on it. And we dubbed strings on it. We had the worst of both worlds. And more than that, look, Van's the greatest, in my opinion, and Jackie Wilson's a great song, but it was a lousy choice for a follow-up single to Eileen, which was the, you know, one of the most original tracks of the year. And we had others like that on the album that we could have done, you know. But there you go, that's life. And after that, I was pissed off. And I said, okay, I'm choosing the next one. And I chose one that wasn't even on the album that I'd just written. Let's get this straight from the start. And I think it was just more or less to sort of state the point, really. I thought very conceptually, and I thought people have got used to this with strings. They want to hear more with strings. And really, you just needed to release a good song, really. But anyway.
Bill, we're talking about your relationship with a record company. What you did with your first album is extraordinary. And I'm amazed this isn't a sort of more famous story, the way you basically stole the tapes.
Yeah.
Did you not? Yeah. It's amazing. You actually did it like a heist.
Why did you steal the tapes, Kevin? What was going wrong?
It's an amazing, so it's, Pete it's Wing, an amazing
Pete,
story.
Pete Wingfield, right? He's producing.
Yeah, sweet man.
18 with a bullet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great producer, Pete Wingfield. Yeah. I mean, you know, all of these things now, the first thing I have to say is, like I say, they were all just stupid things, which not only took away emphasis from the music and what we were about, but you know, we lost the record company with that, you know? And
I can see how that would happen.
Yeah.
Why did you do it? Did you didn't like the sound of the production?
It was to do with the deal, wasn't
no,
it?
No, was it was nothing to do with the production. I was very happy with the album.
Yeah.
Totally happy.
Right.
We'd gone to the record company and said, we're on a really lousy deal, by the way. I mean, awful. Mm. And we'd gone to them. Gino had got to number one about 3 months earlier. This is, we're starting the album, and we.
Which I bought.
Hey, nice one. So, we said, look, can we have a better deal? And they were like, well, not really, and all that. They were mucking us around, you know, and they offered us one point, and it was lousy, beyond lousy, anyway. And do you know what? But it wasn't about the money. It wasn't really about the money, you know. The same with the press thing. A few weeks later, we put adverts in the press, slagging the press. It was, I think it was sort of fear driven control and wanting to have something to fight. And I don't know. You know.
But was Bernie Rhodes managing
no.
you at that point?
He was out after the first single because he produced, in inverted commas, the first single and destroyed the song, really. And, we didn't have an incredible start, really, and we didn't really have anybody who was supporting us. So it did start to get a bit like us against the world. Because what happened with the first single, we went down, Bernard said, look, I'll be your record label. And Dave Cork, who used to promote shows on The Clash and people like that, was our manager. He was based in Birmingham. So we were like, great, sounds good, Bernard Rhodes. And then he sort of said, like, we're producers. And I said, who? And he says, me and Mickey. And I said, okay. And I thought, well, Mickey Foot might be better, you know. So anyway, we recorded the single, Dance Dance. It went well. The recording went really well. And I was phoning Bernard saying, okay, when are we going to mix it? Because obviously I want to be there. And he said, soon. And then the next thing, our manager comes around my place, wake me up one morning with a test pressing. And he said, they had to get in the other night. There was no time to call you. And here's a test pressing. Now, I wasn't stupid, and even then I knew that test pressings were about 2 weeks away from the time that you record. You know what I mean? It takes a couple of weeks to master it and then send it away to the factory and get a test pressing back. So I knew I was being taken, you know, and it didn't sound good. Didn't sound anything like as good. I mean, my flatmate went in and he went, oh, nowhere near as you do it good as you do it live, is it? And he's not a musician, he just heard it. And I was like, and you know, I went to, spoke to Bern, I said, look, we got to do this again. He went, no. And he went, the record company love it. And of course, I met the record company later, and they didn't love it. And in fact, they got Dennis Bavel to do a mix of it. All this happened unbeknownst to us. And his mix didn't work either. Unbeknownst to us, all this had happened. So we said, okay, see you, Bernard. And so EMI signed us direct because it was going through EMI. I don't know if I'm giving you too much detail here.
No, this is great.
What's
a couple of things popped into my head here, but it's really hard, isn't it, for you now as a man in your 60s, judging the sort of actions that you did when you were back then in your 20s. It's, you know, you're the almost the father to your younger self in a way, aren't you? You're looking back with judgment in a way that is with sympathy also, but why did I do that? But of course, that's the greatest time to make art, when you're in your 20s, when you're full of dynamic enthusiasm and anger and
you don't know why you shouldn't.
And it, you were creating. All you knew is you were being in a band was about creating an adventure for your life. It wasn't just about making music. You were creating a script that you wanted to look at years later and say, that was really good what we did here. But also, the other thing that popped into my mind is you as a person, you know, who is controlling, in the same way I was, creates this music personally, makes this music, sort of gives a little bit of a way to a producer, and then gives all of it away to a record company who then try and control it. That's infuriating.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's soul destroying. And I knew that we were on a 2-single deal. We didn't get signed on an album deal. And if the next single wasn't right, it would be, see you later, lads. You weren't good enough. But we were good enough. We knew we were good enough. So it was bye-bye, Bernard. And then from then on, you know, we've really, you know, been involved in every, you know, turned up at every mastering session, as well as all the mixes, of course. But, you know, the lot.
I mean, you could literally make a film of this, of that you actually, you lock the studio doors, you grab the tapes, you had a getaway driver, and you actually legged it out of the studio, and you were chased by the police up the A20 or wherever it was.
Some of these stories, some of these stories have kind of grown with, you know what I mean, they've grown. Like,
I'm gonna put a plane in it. I'm gonna embellish it more.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like there was, when it was a Dexys documentary, I was the only one who didn't talk about it. They asked about it, and I just went, you know what? I don't want to increase all these myths.
Right, fair enough.
All right, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Everybody else in the band, and I spoke to the director of the program afterwards, and I said, do you see how they all told different stories? He said, yeah, it's like a subtext. And basically what it was is we did make the plan. They went out of the room. The album was great. We finished it. You know, it's all on the tape. We grabbed all the tapes, including the multi-tracks, just in case they tried to do remixes. And we grabbed everything and we put it in the van. It wasn't a getaway driver. It was our roadie. Now, Pete Wingfield, love him, you know, incredible producer. I mean, there's some great grooves on that album. And what he did is he came down in the studio with us. It wasn't like you go in there, lads, and play. He'd be down in the room with us. He'd be grooving. He'd be counting us in, you know, dancing while we're playing. Really helped us, you know. And kept it very simple. A real soulful guy, you know.
Yes, I've worked with him. He's lovely.
Great. Yeah. So anyway, what Pete did, the gates, we got the gates open, and Pete just put himself in front of the van like that to stop us. He was this really big gesture. And I went to the, Trevor was going to stop. And I went, Trevor, drive, put your foot down, drive. And he did. And Pete jumped out of the way, of course. And the police were called, and they did go after us. But I think one of our band or two of our band had met some young ladies who lived nearby. So we decided to go there because we did think there could be repercussions. So we decided to go there for a couple of hours, let it
lay low.
And then we drove back to Birmingham. And then I went to Harrow, Northwest London, a couple of days later with the tapes. Said, yeah, Mum, stick these under your bed, will you? And that was it.
Kevin, is that why you're in Thailand? You're still in the witness protection.
I am.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
A couple of your soul references were so important to you in the early days. Obviously, Gino Washington. I mean, you saw him. Did you see him play?
Yeah, I did. That's what the song was about. Yeah, I saw him at the Railway Hotel in Wheelstone in 68.
Yeah, because it was that lovely idea of this guy just slogging it out, isn't it? It's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, do you know the thing about Gino Washington, you know, his album, Funky But Blah Blah live album, was the second biggest selling album of 1967 in the UK. Wow. That's without any airplay, behind Bridge Over Troubled Water.
That was 1970.
Oh, was it? Oh.
Yeah.
Some other album.
I would have thought Sgt. Pepper was probably the biggest selling album of 1967. Sorry.
I thought it was a Simon and Garfunkel album, but I could be wrong.
Maybe it was The Sound of Silence or something. Could be.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Second biggest selling album of the year. And he didn't get played on the radio. So he was a big artist. He was filling out clubs. He was great, you know.
And then also you had this guy. Who's the singer from Chairman of the Board?
General Johnson.
Holland Dozier Holland.
That style, which I loved at the time, I didn't quite know about it then. And then I realised afterwards, you know, which you kind of emulated.
To be honest, it wasn't purely General Johnson. I think I just got the idea. I don't know where I got the idea, but it was to put a cry in my voice, you know. And then I started to do it, and I started to change the keys of some of the songs. I went around to Jim's place, and we played them in higher keys. And then I thought, it does sound a bit like General Johnson. And I thought, no bad thing. I mean, was also Reed Petit, Jackie Wilson.
Yeah.
From the 50s. So it was the sole thing, I think.
I think what was interesting about what you were doing, though, is you were sort of ploughing a furrow that no one else was on. You know, that this is, you know, over on my side, you know, you've got the whole new romantic electro stuff. You know, we were going into funk a bit, but it was very different. Yeah. And then you had the sort of leftover stuff from Two Tone going on, but nothing. No one was doing what you were doing. You know, you were trying to create a youth cult yourself, and a style of music yourself that was unique, really. I mean, it was utterly unique. What I think I'm leading to, and the question is, did you feel the pressure that, you know, we need to look like this, or the influence from other artists ever? Contemporary artist in the 80s.
What, to look different to them?
To be like them, to fit in. Your thing was to work against it?
Totally. I mean, I think I always thought, you know, I'd often think, I think I saw one of your band wearing boxing boots at one point. I'm thinking, shit.
John Keeble, yeah.
Yeah, we're wearing boxing boots, you know. So it was always like, oh, listen, I've got this idea. Oh, fuck, someone else is doing that. No, I can't do that. It was always that. We've always got to have our own thing, always.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you were the same.
Yeah.
Do you know Pete Perfidi's book, Broken Greek?
I've read a bit of it.
Because there's a description in there of you on the tune, which he describes as like being the most enlightening. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. He's having basically a full-on religious experience, because he'd just never seen anyone so committed to a performance.
I went back and watched that performance.
Such incredible narrative art.
It was a good performance. I went back and watched it not long ago. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was good.
Sorry, Guy. For a minute, I actually thought he'd seen him on the Tube train when you were talking. You meant the Tube, the TV show. Sorry,
yes,
Oh, I see. I've got to watch
that. Yes, apparently Dex has appeared on the Central Line and gave the most impassioned performance of this.
No.
We're wearing masks, by the way, of course.
You obviously kind of made that big move. I mean, that, you know, from going from the Dex's soul stuff into the string stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was I've tried to focus on how many people left and joined your band and went. I mean,
yeah, there's a whole Pete Frame, Matt, you know,
And there was even one
amazing
point.
Amazing players have been through your band. Amazing.
There was even one point, Kevin, I think you put an ad in saying there was going to be a coup in the group, you know. I mean, I think it was something you invented, but what was going on? Were you in your head, you wanted to change?
Oh, you mean from the first album to the second album?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, we'd released Show Me, and I thought it would have done a single called Show Me in 1981. We did Top of the Pops with you, summer of 1981, I remember it. You were doing Chart Number One.
That's right.
Did the same Top of the Pops. And
did we chat? We must have had a chat. I can't remember.
I don't think we did, actually.
No, we probably hated each other.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
That's how it was in those days, you know.
down different ends of the BBC bar afterwards.
Oh, all of that. And that stalled at 16, that in the charts, that one. And I thought it was going to do better. I mean, I found out later that apparently it had been, what they call them, the strike force, had been away that week on a holiday or something like that. And they were going to be, you know, I found out that later. But I thought, okay, you know, I used to just think in very straight lines. Okay, Brass has had it. We got to think about something new. So I started experimenting with strings, you know. Started getting, first of all, I said to Jim, look, how about learning the cello and the other two brass.
That's players. Did you say that to three, yeah, to three horn players? Yeah. You got them to, they were meant to just get up to speed with string.
Yeah,
string.
How do you feel about being a string section as well as a brass section? They were like, yeah. And they said, well, we'll try. And they did try, you know. And
That's a hell of an ask.
Yeah, it is. But, you know.
You don't try.
They tried anyway, and it wasn't working after a while. So we decided to get some other players in, and we got some people from.
So you were back to hanging around outside the Birmingham Conservatoire, looking for string players.
Well, before long we were actually. We got a couple of students. Yeah. Then what happened is, Kevin Archer, who'd left Dexys in the end of 1980 after the first band broke up, he started also using strings. He was doing some stuff. Bernard Rhodes, funnily enough, who, by the way, I must give him credit for that, talking about the vocal style. He says to me, look, one thing, he said, all good singers have a unique vocal style. And I didn't like him saying that at the time. I was thinking, what? But afterwards, I thought he's right. And that's when I went away and thought, OK, I'm going to develop a style. Because, I mean, I loved Roxy music. Now, where did Ferry's vocal style come from?
It was
absolutely. Yeah,
just incredible. Anyway, so Bernard had said something else in an interview that Kevin and I had both seen, where he said, oh, folk music is going to be a big thing. And we thought, wow, you know, that just sounded so radical in 1980, you know. And, you know, in the same way, like in 78, soul music felt like it was a radical thing, really, you know, to use soul music. And he felt the same and I felt the same. But I wasn't really thinking about it. Anyway, he did some demos and they were really good. And he played me his demos. And what happened was, I listened to them and I said, can I hang on to this tape? I wanted to play it to Jim. And he said, yeah. And I mean, this is quite a long story. I'll try and make it short.
Is this his band, Blue Ox? What they call
Blue Ox Babes?
Blue Ox Babes.
Yeah. So he did say during that conversation where Kevin played me his demos, he says to me, I said, great violin. It was Helen. And Kevin had gone down the music college, and I think he'd probably gone through the correct channels and asked, you know, who is a really good violin player? And they went, oh, Helen, you know, the teachers or whatever. Anyway, and he got Helen to play on the demos. And he said, I said, she's great. And he said, yeah. He said, you know, you should check her out. She'd be good for you. So I said, yeah, we will do. So I think it was Jim went down to the music college, got Helen. And we started off with a cello, viola, and violin. Helen got the players. And we'd done one single, by the way, Liars A to E, and it just hadn't worked with the string quartet. It hadn't worked that great. Anyway, so Helen got this string trio along, and it wasn't bad. We did a couple of demos, pretty good. But I still thought it sounded a bit heavy, and Kevin sounded quite light, and I quite liked that. So for the next single, Celtic Soul Brothers, we used three violins. Now, Kevin used a violin and a Mellotron thing, but it had quite a similar sound.
A melodeon.
Melodeon. And he used a sort of Tamla-sounding keyboard, and it was a really nice combination and a unique combination, and I was definitely too influenced by it, you know. And I'll cut to the chase. He also had a breakdown and a build-up on one of his songs. Now, it's not a completely unique idea, but it's a very unusual idea. I mean, you'd had Bad Manners had I think it was Special Brood a year before had a breakdown and a speed up, and it's like Bend Me, Shape Me, Have a Nagila. There's different songs, but it was a very unusual idea.
James Brown may have done something like that.
Yeah, he did. So,
no, but it was totally standout at the time.
It really was. So, you know, there was a couple of times me and Kevin were starting to fall out a little bit, like he. You know, he went, yeah, I'm forming a really young band. And I thought, is he digging me out? Oh, and he says to me, he said, look, I love Kevin dearly, but at the time he said to me, look, when my band comes out, I'm going to slag you off. Don't take it personally. And I was like, what? So we were a little bit at loggerheads. And once...
It's like wrestling.
So I thought, these three violins sound a bit like Kevin's. Oh, fuck it. I was a bit like that, you know? And then I thought that breakdown and build up is... too good not to use. I mean, two things. One, somebody said, one of the band who was in Kevin's band and was in Dexys for a little while, Andy, had said later, oh, we ripped off his music, his chords, his even his keyboard lines. Absolute bullshit. I was too influenced by the sound, and I definitely nicked the idea of a breakdown and a build and a speed up. With different chords, different melody, different rhythm, and different lyrics. We didn't steal one note, one melody, one chord sequence, one lyric from Kevin's music. But I was influenced by the style and the fact that he had a breakup. And here's the really interesting thing. You know, for years, I was haunted by it, and I just thought, I'm shit, it was all Kevin. You know, but the fact of it is, after Celtic Soul Brothers, we went back to putting we didn't use three violins. We did on a couple of tracks, but mainly we put a bit of trombone, a bit of brass behind it, like on Eileen, to just fill out the sound a bit. And the ironic thing is, and Kevin was really pissed off when he heard Celtic Soul Brothers on Roundtable, by the way, which I completely understand, you know. And he was actually offered a deal by Stiff, and they were going, come on, we'll take Dexys on. And I was just waiting for his record to come out. I thought, okay, it's on now between me and him. And he was offered a two-single deal, and he didn't take it. And I spoke to him years later. I said, Kevin, why didn't you take that deal? Because I knew that he'd been offered it. He said, it was only two singles. I went, fuck, man, we were only on a two-single deal as well.
You cut him in on the publishing in the end, didn't you?
Absolutely. Kevin. Absolutely. But yeah, 100%. Wow. He gets for some considerable amount of years, a considerable amount of the publishing from the whole of the Touraye project. But here's the really interesting thing. Kevin was pissed off, never listened to the album, thought it was all his things on it. I was like haunted, you know, I was really shit. You know, I wouldn't have had any success without Kevin. Fuck this, you know, I'm useless. And then Tim's listening parties, Tim Burgess's listening
Tim Burgess, yeah, yeah.
Last year, they put on Tour IA, and me and Kevin had been speaking before that, and we'd been, you know, and I was like, we'd made contact again after a few years, and I went, Kevin, it's like a part of me's been missing not talking to you, and it was really good. And then we both listened to the album, and then we phoned each other up, and he went to me, he said, so, he says, the sound on Celtic Soul Brothers and the breakdown and the build-up of Eileen, and I went, yep, that was it. Yeah. And that's what was it.
Nothing else, just that.
Not really. There's a couple of tracks where, no, where we used three violins, which sounded a bit like Kevin's, and we probably used a bit more Tamla Motown piano than what we did, than we would have done. Tamla
I
Motown.
Think this, oh. I think,
but if you've got people who are starting from the same place and they're looking to go to a different place and they've been doing the same thing, then you're always getting sort of morphic resonance.
Well, I was more influenced by them than I should have been, definitely, and I regret it. And the last thing I wanted to, and we didn't need to. You know, we didn't need to. We could have put brass behind that sound of Celtics. So it would have been fine. But the real tragedy is that Kevin backed off and didn't release his records. You know, that's a fucking tragedy.
I think what age has revealed to us about you, Kevin. Sorry, my dog wants to get out.
Amazon parcel at the door or something.
What age has revealed about you, Kevin, is you know, the outside impression that you gave in those days was of someone who knew exactly what he wanted, was going to get there, really cutthroat, didn't matter what else was going, who was falling by the wayside sometimes. We were going to make these records, you were going to have the concept your way. But now we know secretly that there was this insecurity going on all the time, which you're completely open about now, obviously.
Yeah, I think that insecurity was driving me. You know, I had no idea I was insecure. I'd never even stopped to think about it. I was just so driven, you know. But there you go. But I was very lucky. I feel I was very lucky because the best thing that happened to me, it might sound bizarre, you know, we all took drugs and there's plenty of drugs around. I mean, I didn't really take too many drugs during that period. But as Dexy started to go, after Don't Stand Me Down, I was just like, where's the drugs? And you know, the best thing that happened to me is I had 5 years of intensive cocaine addiction. Best thing that happened to me is I became a cocaine addict. I got into a program of recovery, which was, to begin with, hellishly frightening and baffling and confusing. And it was like everything I knew was being challenged. But it sort of, you know, led me onto a path of, you know, discovery and looking at myself. Happiness. And it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, really.
I don't know what you're talking about. It'd be nice to have a look at Don't Stand Me Down.
Sure.
And how you could, which is like your nearest thing to a sort of concept piece. The fact there was no singles, there was no, and it's like, and like I said, a lot of dialogue.
Well, I think the most concept thing we did was One Day I'm Gonna Saw, which came out in 2012. Right. That was a whole narrative right the way through.
Which I just want to say now, I love that album. I came to see you play it.
No, you did, mate. Bless you.
Brilliant, brilliant record. And I had a re-listen to it recently. Still so good.
Bless you.
Yeah, but the story and that particular look for Don't Stand Me Down, which was, you know, which was around, which was sort of 1969, but kind of very straight.
Yeah, it was sort of that cover, and it's like a Terence Davis film, isn't it, or something? You know, it's quite beautiful.
Terence Davis, the long day closes, that guy.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it looks like a still from one of his movies.
How interesting. Just what happened to me is like, you know, we went to America early 83 with the Tour IA album. And I was just walking down Madison Avenue on my own one day, taking a stroll through New York, as I love to do. And I stopped at a shop window, Brooks Brothers.
That's in your video, isn't it? You have that, your character going down New York, down New York.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is what she's like. Yeah. And, you know, I looked into Brooks Brothers and I saw these clothes, these Ivy League clothes, which is exactly what I was wearing in London, in Northwest London in 68, 69, really. It was what the media called skinhead, but it was actually a very, you know, sophisticated Ivy League look, you know. And I just was like, wow. And I just started buying the clothes, really. That was it.
You supported Bowie during that American tour at one point, didn't you? Is that true?
Not in America, but in France we did.
Oh, in France.
Yeah. Which tour? Not the on the Sirius Moonlight tour?
Yes.
Oh, so did I.
With Ice House,
an Australian band. We supported them in Milton Keynes and Edinburgh. And, Milton Keynes and Edinburgh and Rotterdam. Uh-huh.
Okay.
But you you know, you knocked Michael Jackson off number one, didn't you? I mean, Christ, that's with Billy, you knocked Billie Jean off of number one. I mean, it was huge in America.
Yeah.
Was there a sort of like, what I should be doing is more of this stuff now? Because you know what Americans are like. They definitely wouldn't like change. They wouldn't like the idea of you going back and not doing another Irish sounding, you know, soul, Irish soul record.
Yeah, was, I mean, there was a couple of people said that, you know, we need another album, Kevin. We need it in the fall. This was like in spring 83 or something. And we probably only had a couple of songs at that point.
By the way, which one's Dexy's?
Hey?
Which one of you is Dexy?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Which one, yeah, I love you guys. Which one's
exactly,
Dexy?
All of that. All of that. The first time we played in New York in 1980, there's a guy, he was a really nice guy called Jerry. You know, he's the A&R guy, and he came. And I used to start the show saying, okay, something like, in here, nothing but confusion. In here, nothing but soul. Comes in the dressing room afterwards. I fucking love it, man. Here, I got confusion. Here, I got soul. You know how they go on and on.
But, I think my point was, Kevin, is that, you know, you made an album that was tough for people. You know, you didn't want to release singles initially. There's a 12-minute track on it. I want to say I love the album. I mean, I think the album is really got... I mean, I texted Guy last night saying that, you know, how incredible I thought that... that the long track on
What She's Like, which begins
with a
with that brilliant, very ominous, that very ominous little sort of exchange
conversation at the beginning.
What were you talking about?
It's a 12-minute piece of theatre, a storytelling piece of theatre, and it goes into Beach Boys backing vocal style and breakdowns, and I mean, it was not going to smash the charts up by doing that, was it?
We didn't
release it.
We didn't release it. We you know, look, I remember, like, that was always written to be a single. You know, that's why I say things about, you know, unfulfilled potential. I think that album could have done really well. It wasn't uncommercial. You know, what's pop? Somebody said to me about pop lately. Pop just means popular. It's not a style of music, I don't think. And it just means that people like it. So there was... You know, if we'd have really, there's a track on there called Listen to This. If we'd have released that, I think we'd have got airplay. I just think this is what she's like. I originally thought, okay, the demo was about 6 or 7 minutes. You know, there was talk at one point while we were like, we'd been trying different producers. We ended up producing it ourselves with the help of Alan Winstanley. But, you know, Trevor Horn was mentioned at one point and Relax had just come out, which I thought was great. And while we were recording it, and, you know, looking back, that would have been a really good thing. He would have got it, but I was frightened that, you know, I'd had quite a few bad experiences with producers, and I just thought, you know...
Yeah, but it would have sounded amazing, whatever it was.
You know, I would have liked him. You know, thinking about it, he would have probably got it, and it would have been all right, you know. But anyway, and I thought that was meant to be a single. I think I was going to our manager, look, we're going to release just a long track, a 6-minute single. You know, Bohemian Rhapsody was 5 minutes, 5.5 minutes.
Thought, art for art's sake. You know, 10cc, Art for Art's Sake. I think that was like 6. Or Find Mandy, Fly Me,
it,
you know.
Could be done. We wouldn't have had the conversation on the front of it, obviously. You know, but we would have been, we could have done an edit of that. And, but the manager at the time went, oh, don't release a single at all. And I just thought, oh. And then I just got into this thing. And I think, you know what, the Jackie Wilson thing. And I just think I just got, you know, I was going to America and you probably had it, Gary, like, except you might have had somebody around you that was just a bit more empathetic. And I didn't really have too much of that. So I was doing interviews for breakfast, interviews all day. You were showing the evening. And when I got after those tours, I was just like, get me the fuck out of here. And I just thought, I felt like I was a pop. I didn't want to be too pop, you know, I just wasn't enjoying it. And I just thought I really need to do something with some depth. I started to get interested in politics more and stuff like that. And that all went into Don't Stand Me Down.
I think when you look back on Don't Stand Me Down now, it's an incredible piece of work. And in a way, it was kind of unfairly judged because the people on the pop side in journalism and magazines were shocked by it because it wasn't, you know, doing what everyone else was doing or what they expected you to do. And the people on the art side had already given up anyone who had committed to pop music beforehand.
That's it. We fell in between the two. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I am. I absolutely. And in a,
But also the thing of putting out an album without singles was something that people could have done before you'd done this, because especially it was more of an American thing because they had album radio. They had all those radio stations that would play album tracks.
But there was bands, a lot of people say they didn't like rock music that much in the 70s. I actually didn't. Apart from the odd thing here and there, I didn't really like it that much. I mean, but what I was aware of, bands like Led Zeppelin and Yes, and all them bands were selling bucket loads of albums in the 70s and not releasing singles.
Yeah.
You didn't hear them on the radio.
Yeah, that's because there was the rate. You did in America. That's the thing.
But
they
here you
those
didn't.
Stations,
or rather, in the UK, you didn't. Yeah. And they were still doing well here. And I just thought, why not? Let's do that. And what I wanted was to try and get out of the pop thing. I was just a bit, I was just tired of that, really. It's like a job in itself.
So was the answer to that to lose the Dexys moniker and just say, well, I'm just going to do this on my own now? Is that why you never made another Dexys album after that?
No, I think we didn't make another album. Well, I think we make another album after that. Don't Stand Me Down was exhausting. It was 2 years, really, really hard work. I mean, there's stories that we got lost and didn't know which tape. That's all bull. We always knew what we were doing. But it was like we were going for the holy grail of playing, and it never really took off until we got the right drummer, and that was Tim Dancy, who was Al Green's drummer, and we got him over.
Oh, right.
And it was Helen's idea. We were trying all these drummers, and they were great. And we get one track. We had Woody Woodmans, he did a track with us, and we got the waltz from that. Oh, wow. We had another American drummer. And then we went to see Al Green, and then we were still trying to find drummers. Al Green was great. And Helen just said, well, why don't you just get that guy over? And obviously, we had the money to do that, and we just phoned up Willie Mitchell or whoever it was and said, look, the drummer who played with Al Green at the Albert Hall, can we get him, please? He came over. We sent him the demos. He was amazing. And the first track we did was a track called One of Those Things off the album. And he come in the studio and he's just looking around. He's a Memphis boy and he's going, looking at all the equipment and nice dish you got here, man. Okay, all right. And I went, he's doing that for a few minutes. And I went, Tim, you want to come in and have a look at the track? Have a run through? He went, not yet, Kev. Not yet, man. What tempo is that thing? And I said, about 118. Put that metronome on 118. And I put the metronome 118. And then he's just bobbing around to the tempo, 118, for about 10 minutes. All right. And then talking to everybody, bobbing his head, let's go do that thing, Kev. And then we went into the room, man. And it's just first take.
Oh. It's funny you said, I've got a story about that. There's a thing called the Holy Ghost that Willie Mitchell, this is apparently what Al Green's band used to do. And the Holy Ghost was you get the band in the room and you would get exactly what he did. You get the tempo of the song and the band would stand around and they clap it. And they all clap until it's literally just one clap. Wow. Until they're all absolutely zoned in. Then it's like, go,
all in it. Yeah.
So that's exactly that's where that comes from. And it's brilliant. Wow. It's most beautiful. It's called the Holy Ghost.
Love that story.
Yeah.
Kevin, you went off and did your solo albums, and there was some beautiful stuff on that.
It was Helen was a massive part of that. Helen O'Hara and Billy Adams, they were a massive part of that. That wasn't me. That was all of us. When I would weaken and think, oh man, this is just taking forever, and like somebody would be doing a take, and I'd go, oh, just fucking pass it. Helen would go, no. No, it's not right. And if Billy was not on it that day and prepared to compromise, I'd go no. And so between us all, we did that album. But anyway, I just wanted to make.
Want to mention.
Well, that's really nice to hear. That's nice.
I want to mention
that,
just one track off of the solo stuff you did, because I thought that your version of The Greatest Love is really special. It's really amazing.
Thank you, man.
And I think there's always this battle between the technical of singing and trying to connect your voice to your emotions.
Yeah.
And I feel you, on that track, you're leaning into just saying, I'm just going to connect to my emotions. That's what's really the most important thing about this. I could hear it's you. You're not trying to sound like any soul singer. But it's so connected, Kevin. I think it's a really wonderful version of that song.
Bless you, man. That's so nice that you say that. And I'm really pleased to hear that, because I really do think that worked, I'm really proud of that. I don't know how it happened, but it happened. I was very conscious of that song. I'd heard that song, but I'd never really heard it until one day I was trying to stop taking cocaine. And I remember I drove down to the West Country And I was driving down and I had this tape, Soul 77, and I put it on. And it was the George Benson version I heard. And I put it on. I don't know why. I was just in tears listening to it. So when the time came, I knew I've got to record that version of that song. But I thought, I've got to find my version. So I really tried to get inside the lyrics and I changed them and I tried to fit it to my own experience. And I took each line. I had a very good singing coach who just said, take each line and ask yourself what it means to you. And I did that. And I wrote it down, probably like you do with acting and stuff, you know. And I did feel I got it. And I worked on my voice technically. But, you know, like, as you know, what happens yourself with music, what you're looking for is that transcendent thing when it's just happening. You're not consciously doing it. It's happening. You're in it. And that's exactly what happened. And that's what happens with the best music. And that's what we all hope for, right?
I've got to say, this might be an odd one, and it's actually really not one of my favourite Springsteen songs, but I really loved your Thunder Road. There was something in that that really connected.
My head's getting big now.
So that wasn't on the original album, though, was it? That got added later.
It got added later, and then a myth started coming around that Springsteen didn't like it, which was just bull. Gary, you'll understand this, having dealt with record companies. When I signed to Creation, and I like those guys, you know, nice guys, I ain't slagging them.
But we had Alan on the show, yeah.
Here's a demo. It wasn't Alan, it was another guy, Dick. I said, Dick, here's a demo of Thunder Road. Now, I'm changing some lyrics here, as you can see, and here's the lyric sheet that I want to use. And here's a letter to Bruce Springsteen. Please pass this on to his management, his publishers. This is like 18 months before the track came out. They went, yeah, no problem. Of course, I never checked up, and I just got on with recording the album. The inevitable happened. Okay, did we get permission for that track? Oh, no. And so then they said, we'll do it tonight. Well, they're not going to agree it now. So they sent a fax. Can we change the lyrics of this song to that? Of course, his publishers said no. Anyway, this time we had plenty of time. So luckily, my management, who are in America, know his management. I did the same thing, wrote a letter to Bruce explaining why I needed to change the lyrics. And asked, you know, would you mind? Would that be okay? And I've sent our version. And we got the permission about a month later.
Fantastic. Really
there you go.
Fantastic. Do you think there'll ever be you trying to make another Kevin Rowland album? Or have you suddenly now realised that Dexys is you and that's the best way of presenting any music you record?
Well, I don't think it's just me, but, you know, it tends to be... you know, like you said about the label after Touré saying you're going to do another Touré, I couldn't do it. I can only do what I think is the right thing. I just can't do anything else, you know. So I don't think I'd be able to sing somebody else's lyrics or, I mean, unless I, you know, I mean, when I say that, I mean, like a collaboration. I've tried to write lyrics with somebody else. I'm like, no, I can't do that. You know, I can take a song and hopefully try to make it my own, you know, but. No, I just feel that as much as anything, I don't want to do it on my own. I don't want the pressure of doing it on my own. You know, I must admit, I don't know about you, Gary, but I find this business, you know, quite pressurized, really, even now. And
I mean, I have to say, I find it less pressure doing things on my own than with a band. I like being in the band I'm in with Guy, with Nick, but I'm just saying, yeah. You know, when you go back to the same, you know, structure that you worked for you as kids but doesn't work for you as adults. I think what I'm trying to get to as well really is that it feels like with you redoing Touré, going back to it, it's like you suddenly embracing your past and saying, do you know what, I know I moved on, but I'm also hugely grateful and I can see the heart of what I created and I'm embracing it now.
Gary, I'm hugely grateful. There isn't the day goes by. I don't remember the last, well, maybe the odd day, but there's not many days don't go by. I'm not grateful for where I am, the fact that I'm here today, the fact that I've got some money, that I'm not broke, that I didn't end up some other way. Do you know what I mean? That I've got, you know, royalties and that. Do you know what I mean? I'm hugely grateful for that. No, but on the contrary, Touré is really, this remix is about righting the wrong. You know, I just felt that album was nowhere near as, didn't sound as good as it should have done. And it sounds way better now. Be happy to send you the mix if you want.
Oh, can't wait. And you're taking it on tour, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're doing shows in November, October.
We'll definitely come to that.
Who's the band?
Please do. Me, it's Jim, it's Helen, it's Sean, and I think probably a lot of film footage.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I enjoyed that.
I really enjoyed that. He's all the passion and the intensity, but not to a point that was scary. Like I've
you were frightened. Yes. No, he.
We both were.
Yeah,
we
of course
both
were. No, he's definitely mellowed, as they say.
No, there's a lovely connection between you two, which I really like, which is why I've taken a bit of a backseat. Aww. So,
yeah, he's. No, and really I tell nice. You what, if you bump into Kevin,
it's quite nice that sometimes it's like being a listener. You know, it's nice.
Was I chatting too much? I'm so sorry.
No, yeah. No, that's not what I meant at all. That's not what I meant at all.
What's amazing is when you bump into Kevin in the street, whatever day, whatever time, he looks amazing. He's thought about everything, down to the socks and I'm sure the underpants.
Yeah, no, last time I saw him, funnily enough, was in the sort of posh mod clothes shop in Brighton. And we recognised each other. And yeah, and he looked immaculate. I did.
thank you so much for listening. As usual, and thank you to our producer, Ben Jones. And we'll be back... next week or at some stage with someone equally as brilliant.
Yep. Yeah, so it's good night from me.
And it's good night from they.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.